Welcome back, Justin, to the DMZ.
Bill, thanks for having me back on.
No problem. Matt Lewis is having a little summer respite, a little vacation. I will take one myself next week. I believe you'll be back next week for a mega conservative DMZ.
Well, indeed. Or I can just be, I can just become liberal for a week for the fun of it.
As you are a rhino, I imagine that'll be easy for you.
Always.
I think the conservative commenters might have a hard time saying who is the bigger rhino, you or Matt, as you're both very radical. That's like only an indication of how far to the right the country has gone.
So I
do like talking to you because like Matt, I think you give a good candid appraisal of the center of gravity within the conservative movement and the strategic wisdom of the leading light. So there is a big push right now in this August recess time, gearing up for a big round of budget talks next month. The government shuts down on September 30th if there is no agreement to have a government operations bill. Mm-hmm. And there is this big push to say, we should insist on defunding Obamacare in any budget bill. And if there's a shutdown, then we'll then blame Obama for not agreeing to shut down Obamacare. This seems to be getting some pushback even in some conservative quarters. The Republican leadership is not for it. But in the midst of all this, you have these delays. We've delayed the employer mandate for a year. Now there was a report that actually back in February there was another delay regarding caps on consumer out-of-pocket costs for certain insurers. Is this putting the wind in the sails of the defund Obamacare movement, or is these just little bumps in the road that don't amount to very much?
I think that we'll know more when we see who wins the intra-party debate within the conservative movement. It seems to be pretty clear that in the last few days, few weeks, that House leadership and Senate leadership have asserted themselves versus the far-right flank. You had today, Avik Roy posted an essay, basically, at National Review, saying, look, guys, this defunding Obamacare is perhaps the silliest, least strategic method possible if the end goal is to get rid or to significantly reform Obamacare, that it makes much more sense to attack on the edges to force red state Democrats to take votes on things like delaying the individual mandate, delaying the implementation of the exchanges, and in other words, pushing back the date at which these things will begin, attacking it from the edges as compared to a full frontal charge. I mean, it's sort of like saying that Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and Rand Paul want to do a Pickett's charge, and the GOP leadership and moderate or establishment Republicans are saying this is going to fail and fail dramatically, so perhaps let's not do that. But these every time that there is an administration delay, it does, at least in a sense, add a little bit of fire back into the idea that Obamacare can be, in some sense, pushed back against. This out-of-pocket cost thing, I think, is perhaps being overhyped in the sense that it is a relatively small chunk of the population that is going to be affected. It's plans that are not being grandfathered over. It's going to be impacting people with chronic conditions and not the big chunk of the population. So we will see where it goes from here. The actual caps on out-of-pocket costs are, it's a major component of Obamacare, but delay is different than simply saying, throwing hands in the air and saying we can't do it. There is a strong populist argument against it by saying that, again, the administration and implementation has prioritized the interests of insurers and corporations over individual consumers. But I'm just not sure where you go from there in terms of using it as a bludgeon against the administration.
I mean, certainly as a legislative matter, it's not going to make a Democratic Senate change their mind. It's not going to make Obama whip out his pen to sign the legislation.
Yeah. CEO Obamacare. Yeah, no.
And I guess the I mean, we're in agreement as far as the strategic wisdom of doing this. I mean, as Mitch McConnell and others have said, if you actually had a shutdown, you actually don't shut down Obamacare because that spending is mandatory. It doesn't it's not affected by these discretionary bills. But I guess the political question is, is the country angry enough about Obamacare? Is the country livid at these delays that in your argumentation is catering to big insurance and not to individuals? Would Republicans win the message argument, and would that fuel their chances in 2014 to take back the Senate? Or is having a shutdown seen as so colossally reckless and blindly ideological that, as John Boehner apparently has suggested and Karl Rove suggested, not only will you give up winning the Senate back, but you might actually lose the House in the process? And I think that was Avi Gore's point. If you lose, and if that happens, then you're never going to repeal Obamacare because you'll have a Democratic Congress and they'll continue to implement it on course.
Right. Well, and even worse, in terms of implementation, when further delays come up, or when there are further questions about reform, you're going to have a Democratic House and Democratic Senate instead of having a GOP House that can say no to reforms that it does not particularly enjoy. So it's a, I don't know, I think sometimes you have to say, when a voter looks at a government shutdown, the voter will perhaps blame the party that explicitly has said it will shut down the government.
Yes,
So,
let's
I mean,
play out.
you dig through the polling numbers, and it's not beautiful for how the public will respond to a government shutdown, particularly a government shutdown over an issue that was essentially resolved in the summer of 2012 and then in the election in 2012. So it's a There are, I think there are gains for the Republicans to make around the edges and for reforms to perhaps be put forward. And I mean, there are things that can be done on the edges, but the core of it, the individual mandate, and the idea that people aren't going to get dropped from care and that people can be on the coverage till they're 26, and the idea that people should not be denied the chance to get coverage because they become ill. I mean, I don't see these things ever really going away. It's the rest of it that perhaps could be negotiated with, reformed, but
Well, it seems
You
that
jump off the cliff, you get none of it.
this sort of realistic analysis and less charitably fatalism on your part is to be fiercely resisted by the Senator Mike Lees and the Senator Ted Cruz's. When Karl Rove had a debate with Mike Lee on the Hannity show this week, Mike Lee was basically Karl Rove was explaining as much. And Mike Lee was saying, it's this type of attitude was why we cave all the time. It just seems like there's just a built-in resistance, at least in the Tea Party faction of the party, to any kind of chess playing, any kind of thinking through what the next steps would be. And so how do you deal with that?
I think you just need to start by telling the truth to your voters. The old boss Fromm used to always talk about how a lot of conservatives live within an epistemic bubble and have no idea what's going on. And that was sort of, I mean, the Washington Examiner ran a piece this morning about how a significant chunk of the American population thinks the deficit is still rising, even though it's falling pretty dramatically. And I then, in turn, as I run our social media, I put it on our Facebook page, and it produced outraged results accusing us of shilling for the administration.
You're shilling for sequester. You're shilling
Right,
for.
yeah, I mean, apparently we are, I mean, we are not sycophants for the Obama administration here at the Washington Examiner. But a lot of it is that voters have been told that we will get Obamacare done and gone, that we will impeach the president for his high crimes against the American people, that we will stop this radical takeover of executive power. And it's to the point now where, I mean, we have a revolutionary movement that is beginning to eat itself. So, I mean, you have perhaps the most conservative House Senate minority leader of decades, if not of all time, who is being primaried for allegedly not being conservative enough. So I don't know where to go.
He's not Edward Dirksen. But Put the politics aside for a second. On a policy basis, I mean, are you unnerved? Do you feel these delays in certain aspects of Obamacare reveal that the entire enterprise is fundamentally flawed, or is this actually an example of fears of government programs that government's going to ram things down your throat, and they're going to just do a one-size-fits-all, and they won't have any kind of sensitivities to business concerns? Can't you argue this is an example of, you know, government can be agile, government can listen to constituents and make adjustments as they go to ensure smooth implementations of programs? I would think this would be heartening for those who are skeptical of big government to say, you know what, big government is not just some clunky behemoth. Things can be phased in gradually, and adjustments can be made to ensure a minimizing of hiccups.
I have a few policy I suppose dislikes with the Affordable Care Act. There's been this sort of freewheeling argument over whether or not the setting the full-time standard at 30 hours within the Affordable Care Act for requiring employers to provide care is going to mean the demise of the 40-hour work week. I know that there was a union letter that was circulated that caused a bit of a firestorm and pushback, and I don't know whether now we're on the backlash to that, or whether we're on the backlash of that. But I would prefer that the Affordable Care Act set the full-time standard at 40 hours. I think that is a pretty fundamental part of, what it means to be a full-time American worker. And I am disheartened each time that you see anecdotal evidence come out about businesses pushing people off. And the concern that I have is that you're probably going to have to wait for it to be fully implemented to get a real comprehensive look at what that will, the result of that, at which point I'm not sure what reforms will be able to go back to. And that we will see. I don't see politics as an inevitable thing that will be, once the policy is there, it's there forever. I mean, reforms happen. We reformed welfare in the 90s. So perhaps this is something that if it does not go exactly according to plan that we can reform and fix, but I don't know. And I would prefer that, broadly speaking, that we have that healthcare be stripped down, I think, to the I'm skeptical of how it seems that the banded coverage in the Affordable Care Act, what is offered by the exchanges, it seems that it will be, over time, is going to phase out the idea of catastrophic insurance. That concerns me to an extent. The nuance in that, of course, because nuance is so fun and really, you know, it's going to provide people to click on this excitedly and dramatically, is that the banded coverage, we're just not sure exactly how that's going to go. And provided that the exchanges reach the critical mass of healthy young people, I mean, that they should work, and especially considering they'll be infused with federal dollars. And the last thing I have is I'm just not a huge fan of Medicaid, at least in the sense that we run it today. The health outcomes are dubious. So it does reason to be said that, yes, giving poor people money will help them get better medical care and help them have a better standard of living. It just at times that I wonder if Medicaid is the best vehicle for providing that. And I'm concerned that the expansion of Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act is going to make it less likely that we'll see any kind of real reform in the next few decades. So those are a few of the beefs that I have.
Well, and obviously a lot of the law is experimental in nature. You are trying a slew of reforms to see what is going to be best for both expanding coverage and improving health outcomes, and also of cutting costs. But as I'm sort of a reformer at heart, I prefer doing something to not doing something.
See
what works, see what you learn, and then adjust as you go. If some of your hesitancy bears out, better to have tried it and learned that, and then make those adjustments. And so to answer your previous point, I think we're on that path whether conservatives like it or not. You know, the law is in place. It's going to be tried.
Well, it's happening. It's sort of a matter of I'm hoping it doesn't.
Right. But I think conservatives would be in a better place if they took the posture of, okay, this is happening. let's all just accept reality that's happening. And let's think about what we can do to contribute to the process and show that we have conservative ideas that will make this process go better over time, that we have better ideas for healthcare and not just sit here and try to truncate the process and go back to square one.
Maybe. The basic problem right now for the GOP coalition is that it is now animated totally on the idea that Obamacare can and will be totally repealed. The only people left really who are saying that like this probably won't happen are senators, because they don't have to face an election every 2 years. and in that instance, a shining endorsement for why the U.S. Senate is pretty awesome. No, in the meantime, you see the backlash every time that someone says, like, I would like to offer this reform. Or when House leadership, I believe it was earlier this year, tried to fix that issue with Hill staffers that was created by a Chuck Grassley amendment that was intended solely to embarrass the administration. And ultimately it worked, because it was one of those where if you make government look bad, it will just rebound into those who control the government. So, for the moment, I'm not terribly sure. Even like the primary GOP health policy people will concur that there are ideas out there, but there are no elected officials running with them in any real sense that have any chance of attracting attention and endorsement from a big enough chunk of the GOP base to be meaningful.
Well, perhaps
so I just don't know where we go.
Perhaps once a lot of these Southern Republican states that refuse to control their own health insurance exchanges, maybe after a couple years of federally run exchanges, they'll think, hey, maybe I should try to take this back and show that I can run an exchange better than you guys can. Maybe you just have to wait for that moment.
Isn't that kind of a fun part of the entire process, that you have the federalist chunk of the law is being, they're saying, no, feds, you come in and do it.
It's a crazy missed opportunity. They had a chance to show we have better ideas than you guys do, and they're just ceding the authority to the federal government. It's bizarre.
Yeah, not even ceding it, like forcing it on the federal government. They're saying no. We don't want this nonsense. Don't let us govern ourselves. Don't let us like represent our citizens. We'll just like stuff our fingers in our ears and pretend it's not happening.
If I can segue out of Obamacare.
Yeah.
Another odd pairing of right wing Southern Republicans and big Obama federal government is in this move by Justice to block the merger of American Airlines and U.S. Airways, mm-hmm. which I confess I'm not an expert on the subject. I wasn't prepared to talk about it until an hour ago when you mentioned to me that it was on your mind, and I was just reading up on it. And I notice that this is being done in partnership with several state attorney generals, including Texas. The Texas Attorney General, Greg Abbott, who is the front runner to be the next Texas governor, tore into Eric Holder over the Voting Rights Act, because they're trying to block what Texas is doing with voting rights. American is based in Texas. But the Attorney General of Texas is joining the federal government in suing to block this merger and using federal antitrust law to do it. And his explanation is that he felt that the merger was going – because U.S. Airways is considered to be not as good with service to rural airports. And they thought that those routes were going to get shut down. And so he's partnered with the federal government to break it up. This is a more of an overt partnership with the federal government as opposed to Obamacare, where it's kind of, you know, shake your fist and quietly let the federal government do the hard work for you. It suggests to me a bit of hypocrisy that big government's okay when it serves a specific provincial interest of mine. Otherwise, I'll get on my soapbox and complain.
I've been trying to think through the political angle that I can attach to this. I don't have the slightest clue, because antitrust law is intended to ensure competition and to prevent any corporate entity from gaining so much political power that it can keep others out of the marketplace. I just don't see that. They're citing that it would potentially create hundreds of millions of dollars more costs for consumers a year. Sure, yes. I mean, this consolidation will probably mean fewer flights and higher prices, but that I'm not sure in any sense how fewer flights and higher prices are keeping out a potential competitor or keeping another airline from coming in and swooping in. And the concern that I would have would be much more so if someone was creating a monopoly on airports or creating a monopoly on airport gates. So I'm just not. Yeah, and yeah, I was baffled by the
Don't
idea that
we
the
have
state where
monopolies
the
in
hub
airports and
was.
airport gates?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it was weird because my first thought when I read about this entire thing was, why is the state where American Airlines is hubbed suing American Airlines? It's just a weird story. I'm gonna be really excited to see more reporting on it to sort of unweave some of the deeper background of this. And
But
yeah, I mean, you may
do
be
you
right.
this.
It may be simply a reactionary thing to the fact that rural Texas routes. I mean, Texas is a massive state. People fly all over the place there because it's just so big. Maybe it's a reaction to that, but I can't imagine that concern outweighs the, I don't know, the donor base of American Airlines execs. So I just, you almost wonder if there's like a personal animosity at play here, or if there is a something that we don't fully yet know, which is why journalism is awesome, and I think we'll eventually find out.
But Greg Abbott aside, is the conservative reaction to this high outrage? Is this along the lines of the way the conservatives reacted when the National Labor Relations Board took a swipe at Boeing for moving a plant to South Carolina to try to screw over a union in Washington State? Are they going to go after this, saying is this big government run amok? Why can't airlines, have mergers? Why can't the marketplace, function as God intended? Or are people going to follow Greg Abbott's lead and just say maybe this is not, we have bigger fish to fry right now?
I would suspect that it would be the former. I mean, because that was my initial gut reaction was, what on God's green earth are we using antitrust law for this? And I suspect that Abbott's decision is more provincial than it is based on any ideological leaning or bearing. Well, we will see. I remember that Boeing event as well, and there was a pretty hot reaction. So we will see now if the. I mean, I'm picturing the headline now, which is something to the effect of Obama administration subverts corporate merger, hates capitalism. I mean, it's just like I don't know how in the heck this plays out. But I would like the Justice Department to be a little more, I don't know, less involved in corporate mergers. So we will have to see on that. I
Now,
think
I mean,
unless it.
if you're, I mean, this is one thing that I think when these decisions get made, I don't get lost. I mean, Justifer doesn't declare the merger invalid. They have to take it to
No, they have
court.
to take it. They have to take it to the courts, of
I mean, so
course. I
if
mean,
your
but
concern is
it is
proven
an aggressive
valid,
action. Yeah,
what's that?
sure. I mean, but yet it true. I mean, the Justice Department cannot unilaterally say nope, sorry guys, not going to happen. But it is an aggressive action to take it to the courts.
Sure, but my point is, if you're correct,
Well, then my beef will be with the law, absolutely, not with the Justice Department per se. But I mean, it will be, I suppose, a nuisance that the Justice Department will be the one bringing this about. So we'll see if this does go through. I'd be sort of curious to see if there becomes a stronger push to reform antitrust laws, but that is something that will be, well, the long burn, I guess.
I mean, all that's going to happen now is that the size of the argument will get aired out in court, and a judge will rule. I mean, I don't think we have. I mean, maybe people will make a different argument if justice wins, but I don't think there is a strong case to make that like the game is rigged, that you have a judiciary filled with Marxists who are just going to
Oh,
roll over
hey,
every
you
time
speak
that
for
justice.
yourself, but I'm pretty sure that every one of those judges are Marxist, so.
It would just seem like you have to make your case. And why is it problematic for the federal government to use current law. It's like they're making up law because there's an actual antitrust law in the books, been around for a long time, to say, okay, we're gonna be active in exploring these situations, and if we see a problem, we're gonna bring that problem to the attention of the court. You know, why should that be in and of itself dangerous? Because there's going to be a check on the system. If justice is doing shoddy work, they'll lose in court and everyone will go about their business.
Well, my beef is with the idea that the government has a compelling interest in cases where it's not certain that a corporation can create a monopoly of political power. I think that provided that they're not finding a way to absolutely lock out competition, that I don't see. I don't know. This will be an ideological difference between you and I. I don't really see the government as a necessary counterweight to anti-competitive corporatism, provided that it is unable to lock out competitors.
You're not fundamentally opposed to any antitrust law.
No, by all means, antitrust laws are good things, and there are times when you will need. When corporations will achieve such saturation and such control of any given market, that I would be quite favorable to seeing them forcibly broken up, because when those things happen, they typically also acquire immense political power, and they are able to achieve an incredible amount of rent seeking, which is something that there's a strong public interest in seeing that not happen.
But your argument is that the bar of what is considered monopolistic and anti-competitive should be much, much higher.
The argument now is that they're saying, oh goodness, now we would have four airlines that control 80% of the routes in the country. Yes, but that is not a monopoly in any, sense that passes the smell test. So it will create small regional monopolies that happen to already exist. It will simply unite them under a company instead of two.
Well, part of the argument is that these regional markets where, you know, American and U.S. Airways are now currently competing regionally, that they will now stop competing regionally.
Sure. There's nothing stopping anyone from coming in there to compete with them. There is a beef for local consumers to say, hey, I would prefer that you not, like, stop service to my small town. This is something that has been slowly trending since the end of airlines were deregulated, and it's continuing to trend this way, because you're probably going to in the short to medium term see the federal government completely step away from subsidizing these rural routes, and this will be another piece of it. But just the question that I have is whether antitrust law is necessary as part of this. So we will. I suppose this is why you pay people with JDs to argue this out in court.
but your dream is not just to ding the Justice Department. You want to change the law that would make it impossible for justice to pursue cases along these specific lines.
These specific ones, maybe. I don't like making things impossible. I think that's not terribly helpful. I would like to make it unsavory or just unhelpful. I would like to significantly raise the burden of proof for justice.
Now, another issue that I know caught your attention today is some relatively positive economic news out of Europe. And it's not every day where a conservative approaches me to praise the economy of Europe. So I'm curious what your thinking is there.
Well, against all odds, Germany and France recorded enough growth to pull the Eurozone out of recession in the second quarter, which is, well, after the last few years, it's pretty stunning. It's very good news, because it perhaps indicates that Europe is not as severely doomed as it appeared.
And France is not the black hole sucking the global economy into the abyss.
Whoa, let's not go that far. France is totally a black hole that's sucking everything into it. And Prime Minister Hollande is terrible and should be resisted at all costs. But Europe has implemented over the last 3 or 4 years some pretty terrible economic policy that has been heavily encouraged by the IMF and the World Bank, and that against all odds. It seems like it is beginning to have a marginal recovery, but I mean, the basic problem that I think Matt Iglesias has illustrated pretty nicely is that in every country you can't say, let's go into austerity and shrink back and depress our wages to the point where we're competitive, because if that's happening, no one's buying anything. If every country's goal is to increase their exports, eventually you hit a universality problem, because somebody has to be increasing their imports. But in the broad fund, for the future of the Eurozone, which is immensely important for modernizing and stabilizing Eastern Europe, especially against Russia, it's important for the idea that someday Turkey will become a member of the Eurozone. The Eurozone member states are very favorable to this. They will require a lot of reform, and the carrot of the Eurozone will be something that I think will be quite significant in bringing Turkey into the 21st century. So it's a lot of good news, and to see positive news coming from across the pond is it's quite heartening.
And presumably what's good for Europe is good for America and the global economy. I imagine this might raise a debate whether or not austerity worked.
I think the debate is that it worked in some countries and it doesn't work for others. For small countries with relative, I mean, one reason that austerity was able to work in places like Estonia is that it's a relatively recent capitalist enterprise, that it had a people who were quite accustomed to suffering. I mean, we can handle austerity because life was so terrible under the Soviet domination that our people will remember that and be sort of okay with it for a while. I mean, that was the implicit suggestion that I heard from members of the European Parliament, was that, yeah, well, it's rough, but we've seen worse. And I just, like, oh, sure. But austerity, not so much. I mean, if you want to talk about the other side of austerity, talk to the Brits, because that's not going so hot. And that doesn't look like it's going to turn around. I mean, that's net. And that is a top-tier post-industrial economy,
Europe's growth for this quarter is essentially where our growth is right now. But
we've been trending above. We've been doing much better than them for quite some time.
Right. So is that an argument that what Obama did with the Recovery Act, where we said, okay, we're on the precipice of a deep recession, let's put a floor on it, let's put a big infusion of cash into the system. We'll do half government spending, half tax cuts, but we'll go as big as the politics will allow us to do. That will stop the bleeding. You know, there are folks left saying we didn't do enough. There are folks on the right saying you did too much. But at least compared to Europe, we weathered the storm better than they did, because we were being Keynesian and they weren't. And maybe they didn't go completely kaput, but it's taken them longer to reach this point in the economic cycle than it did us.
Sure. I'm a Keynesian, so raw stimulus, I'm pretty okay with that. And I would prefer that we be okay with further stimulus if necessary. And sequestration was probably not a fantastic idea. We warned against it for months, saying let's not do this, among other reasons, because it will in the long term crush military readiness. So, but it's happened, it's going on, it's probably going to put a damper on growth for some time. We have it, so we have our own little austerity. Fortunately, our austerity came significantly after the stressor moments, as compared to initiating it immediately, because if we would have, say, cut $500 billion from our budget in 2009, I don't imagine either one of us would have a job right now. So
so you're a conservative Keynesian.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Conservatives historically have been, it's like, I don't know. Well, there's a really good pushback going on right now. I mean, Jim Pethikoukas at AEI published something yesterday just going wild on Rand Paul for misstating Friedman's views about the Fed. And so there is a kind of a gulf of opinion between people who, like me, who would just say, let's just throw money at this and let's have the Fed aggressively buying bonds. And open to talk of stimulus versus those who on the far end who are saying abolish the Fed, let's get back to sound money, which is a really solid way of saying that let's put ourselves on a currency reserve that requires us to be aggressively mining for a precious metal, but by all means, I guess. But I mean, most of at least the intellectual movement is somewhere in the middle, is saying, sure, let's have an aggressive Fed, let's have really aggressive bond buying, like Friedman would have preferred, but let's shy away from stimulus because of the knowledge problem, which I think was a reasonably fair critique, and which Bush evaded by just sending out checks. And indeed, as we saw with the stimulus, the influence of guys like the behaviorist who's saying that you need to send out money slowly and surely so people don't notice and adjust their behavior, I think it worked reasonably well. It was disappointing to see the payroll tax stuff come to an end, as I think we discussed this last time. But stimulus is done. It hopefully will not be needed for a very long time, because I prefer not to have this argument again. But we will. So.
But so you're okay with fiscal stimulus being withdrawn at this point, but you want to see monetary stimulus continue?
I think so, yeah. I prefer to see I want a fairly aggressive Fed at this point. And there are a few concerns. There is, a fairly legitimate concern that the aggressive Fed right now is at least in part responsible for a fairly substantial run on land prices for agriculture. You've seen a huge bubble. Part of that is the ethanol mandate. Part of that is a simple scarcity problem. But another part of it is that it's just so incredibly cheap to borrow right now that farmers are substantially expanding and that land prices are going through the roof. So you will probably see in the next 5 to 10 years a fairly substantial collapse in ag land prices. So I think that's one thing that will be affected. And I, to an extent, worry about the impact it's had on municipal bonds and dragging people to municipal bonds for a lot of municipalities that are going to be experiencing significant debt crises over the next 10, 15 years. Because unlike the feds, they can't just aggressively borrow. So we will see. But on the whole, yeah, buy the bonds.
So does that put you in the Janet Yellen camp over the Larry Summers camp?
I mean, give me Romer, but that's not going to happen. Yeah, but yes, I prefer Yellen. Although a little trollish piece of me wants to see Summers go through the process so that you can watch people who remember the Clinton era go absolutely bonkers. I think it would single-handedly put Occupy Wall Street back on the street if they actually cared. So, so I would enjoy that as a journalist and as a right-leaning pundit. But I don't think it would be.
That's why I find the Fed Summers in the mix sort of odd, because usually the Fed you want to be very low-key and nondescript, you know.
Well, also not like moving markets on words, like, yeah, which I could see Summers doing.
It just doesn't seem temperamentally the right fit for you, regardless of what you think about his economic acumen and his track record, all that stuff. I just think personality-wise, not the kind of guy you would normally have at the Fed.
Oh, you're saying that being bombastic is not great for a Fed chairman? I mean, T-bills move world markets, so yeah, perhaps to have someone who is muted and calm and not Larry Summers. So, but we'll see. I mean, this is an issue where I understand that I have absolutely no say, so I can just casually chat about it with and know that it has no implication on what actually happens.
Well, any other issues percolating now that are on your mind today?
Something for everyone to be watching is that there is slowly but surely a continuing negotiating process for a transatlantic treaty process between the Eurozone and the United States. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really have anything to do with trade in any meaningful sense. You won't see American farm foods being eaten in Europe. You won't see GMOs suddenly allowed in all across Europe. And you probably won't see terribly many European products. But it does have some positive offerings in it, which the primary one is that it would allow U.S. and European regulators to harmonize their processes, which would mean that a lot of the regulation that we do of goods coming from overseas, we could significantly reduce some redundancies there and significantly reduce some costs. And make it much easier to regulate markets in places like Bangladesh and China and Vietnam, which would be good. So we will, this process.
I know the concern on the left with all this, are they going to be, you know, defining the standards down in the process?
If the U.S. and the EU markets together announce a set of that would be, that would create by far the largest global harmonized market. So it would be, it would force some changes in practices that would probably be very good, especially if you care about things like workers' rights, or if you care about things like, you know, drugs that are safe to use and are not going to kill people, and foods that are safe. These are, there's a lot of promise in this treaty. The Europeans are incredibly excited. Americans are totally ignoring it because, I mean, by and large, we'll get fairly favorable terms no matter what, because the Europeans want it so desperately. So it's just, it's something to watch for. And when you see the headlines in the Times and the Journal talking about it, take a few minutes to read it, because it'll be something to watch out for. They're very excited. It should lead to a small growth bump. I think it's being overstated, but every little growth bump in eras like this is probably helpful. So watch out for that. That's my quick spiel for the why Europe matters more than we think.
Well, great to talk to you, Justin. I'm glad to have you back on. I know folks look forward to seeing you talk to Matt next week. Where can folks find your stuff?
Twitter. I'm the online editor for the Washington Examiner, and I am on Twitter at jgreendc, which is, you can read below you on the screen.
And I got to say, I hopped on your Twitter feed in the morning to see what was on your mind, and you've tweeted more in the past hour than I do in a month. So if folks want to keep tabs on what's going on in the conservative universe, you know, Justin's feed is not a bad place to start.
Thank you much. Good times as always.
I'll talk to you soon. Take care.